Chapter 35. In the book Stars, Fans, and Consumption in the 1950s, Reading Photoplay, published in 2014, author Sumiko Higashi compiled photographs and titillating facts about a gallery of beauties, including Marilyn Monroe, as portrayed in various issues of the Photoplay magazine during that decade. Regarding Marilyn, the author wrote in the book, "Among the alluring blonde bombshells constructed as a social type by the movie studio system to embody female sexuality, the most famous, of course, was Marilyn Monroe. As a full-page color pinup in 1951, Marilyn had already projected the self-conscious flirtatiousness that characterized her as a sex symbol. With her painted lips parted in an engaging smile, she showed off her cleavage in a low-cut bathing suit and her legs in strappy platform sandals. An accompanying story gave her vital statistics, 38, 28, 36, and acknowledged the artifice in her glamour. A line teasingly informed readers that she did not sleep in either nightgowns or pajamas and loved fluffy comforters." Photoplay had supplemented this depiction of Marilyn's image over the years. She was named by the magazine Most Important New Star of the Year in 1953, with story after story ranging from the sublime to the ridiculous. Topics included Marilyn Monroe, Temptations of a Bachelor Girl, I Want a Woman Like Me, Marilyn's Mysterious Mother, Desperate Marilyn Poses Nude, Marilyn Monroe's Mother Escapes Mental Hospital, and The Love Letters That Could Have Saved Marilyn's Life. In the August 1963 Photoplay issue, a shocking article was included, and, much like everything else about the famous movie star's life, it is shrouded in mystery. The article had been hiding in plain sight for nearly 60 years, but, for whatever reason, was never exposed, and thus not given the close scrutiny it deserves. This author first noticed mention of the article in an FBI memorandum obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, dated July 9, 1963, 4.5 months before John F. Kennedy was assassinated. The memo is addressed to a Mr. Deloach, whose full name is Cartha Dekel Deloach, otherwise known as Deke Deloach, Deputy Associate Director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation during the 1960s. He was the third most senior official in the FBI after J. Edgar Hoover and Clyde Tolson. At the top of the memo is the name Marilyn Monroe, written in unidentified longhand, followed by indecipherable scribbling. The subject line reads, in caps, "Photoplay article concerning Marilyn Monroe's death." Although the article was published in the magazine with the designated date of August 1963, exactly 1 year after Marilyn died, the magazine apparently was released in July, and famed columnist Walter Winchell, a rival of Dorothy Kilgallen's, secured a copy. This appears true, since the memo's first sentence states, "Walter Winchell's column in the July 8, 1963 issue of the New York Mirror contained the statement, 'Photoplay's current article on the man who killed Marilyn practically names him.'" The second paragraph begins, "In accordance with your request," indicating Deloach had asked for the written memo. The agent replying, an M.A. Jones, then wrote, "There follows a brief review of the information concerning Marilyn Monroe in the August 1963 issue of Photoplay magazine." Agent Jones then details what Winchell wrote in the same magazine about the article, basically dismissing what was written. Winchell says the author of the articles, which are syndicated in papers on the continent, claims he personally interviewed many people in Hollywood and New York who were aware of Miss Monroe's problems and claimed his sensational story was big news. Continuing, Jones reported, "The big news, according to Winchell, was the name of the married man involved." Jones then adds, "Winchell says, many of us on the papers and in the magazines have hinted at the name, and the foreign correspondent has jumped to conclusions. Winchell says there is no proof that the married man was the villain, and many of Miss Monroe's friends now believe the overdose of sleeping pills was an accident. The final line in the first paragraph, written by Jones, reads, "Winchell claims much of the foreign correspondent's story was recognized by him as having appeared in Photoplay and the Hearst newspapers for which Winchell writes." In the next paragraph, Agent Jones writes, "The article concerning Miss Monroe begins on page 52 under the caption, 1 year later, Marilyn Monroe's killer still at large." And then, "A review of this article reveals Winchell's claim that it practically names the man who killed Marilyn is nothing more than a, redacted, plug for a cheap magazine." Continuing, Jones wrote, "Actually, the article comes no way near identifying anyone. The only clues to the identity of the alleged married man who had an affair with Marilyn and caused her suicide when he rejected her could apply to any number of prominent individuals." After writing, "These clues are," Jones then includes further excerpts from the article, which summarize the author's perception of the ill-fated love affair between RFK and Marilyn, as noted in the ensuing paragraphs taken directly from the article. Interestingly, despite the memo quoting Winchell's opinion in the column "Walter Winchell of New York, Man About Town" of New York Mirror about the Photoplay article, namely, "Photoplay's current article on the man who killed Marilyn practically names him," the statement does not appear in Winchell's column "The Midnight World of Walter Winchell," starting on page 10 of the August 1963 Photoplay issue. The Photoplay issue mentioned throughout the FBI memo, which included the controversial article's posting on page 52 as noted in the memo, would not have called attention to the accusations therein about Marilyn's death, since the cover featured a photo of actress Debbie Reynolds and her daughter. In fact, no mention of the article is even printed on that cover. Of interest is that the author of the article is never mentioned in the FBI memo, and the only reference to who he or she may be stems from the memo stating that it is a foreign correspondent. Tracking down the author of the article, not articles as stated in the memo, was only possible when this author secured an original copy of the magazine. Surprising was the fact that the journalist who wrote it was not a he at all, but a she named Martha Donaldson. Winchell thus had his facts mixed up across the board. However, excerpts from the article by Donaldson, about whom no background details have emerged despite extensive research by this author, do appear credible based on the details given, which basically outline the defining moments of the ill-fated love affair between Marilyn and Robert Kennedy. Yes, Agent Jones is correct that Kennedy is not identified as the married man, but the Attorney General's shadow swirls around at every turn since her affair with JFK had been brief and was over while RFK's had been ongoing for months. A close reading confirms this. Who else can it be but Bobby? Alongside the headline in red and white capital letters, Donaldson wrote on page 52, "You can see him in a crowd. You can reach out and touch him because he is a great man, famous, known all over the world, and maybe that touch will give you at least a small part of him. You can see him on television or even in a movie theater, and you will look up to him and think how lucky his wife is to be married to him and how lucky his children are to have him as a father." Continuing on, the foreign correspondent wrote, "And maybe you'll think, I wish I were his wife. You can read about him almost any day in the newspapers and magazines, and you will think, this is a good person, this is a truly honorable man. But what you will never read, never see, never know, is that this man is a killer. He is the man who killed Marilyn Monroe." Regarding the details of the relationship, Donaldson added, "When their romance began, nobody, especially Marilyn and the man, could have guessed at the ending. For it began with a kind of love. It was the worst time of her life and best time of his, and so each of them needed someone to share that time with. That was their love, their need, really. It was kind of love gone wrong. The reason why? For he is very much happily married. Marilyn, of course, knew that. He had no intention of ever divorcing his wife. She knew that, too. But he had been so on top of the world at that time that he had to have a celebration of his good fortune. His career had reached a height he never before dreamed it would, and there were obviously better things in store for him. And what better celebration than to have the world's most desirable sex symbol in love with him? Despite the calamity of the relationship, the author wrote, most of all, she had never found the love she'd been looking for, the love that was going to make her forget all her past unhappiness, the love that would make her world a beautiful place. So she went on looking, and not finding, and then there was the man. She needed him. She needed his confidence and his vitality. Because if this man was so confident of himself and of his future, and since he'd chosen her, didn't that mean he believed in her, too? And if he believed in her, then she couldn't be as bad as she thought she was. On pages 74 and 75, Donaldson wrote, besides, to her, there was always the faint possibility that he would marry her, and they would live happily ever after. But it was all a dream, and somewhere inside her she knew that. The journalist then added, he explained to her that they'd never marry. He loved his wife, he told her, though he loved her, too. And there was his career, he told her. Any scandal would ruin it, and he'd never allow that to happen. As far as the man went, the author wrote, he had a need for Marilyn, and he allowed himself his indulgence. It was to be his fatal flaw. Pointing directly at Bobby as the subject of the article, Donaldson then wrote, and so they spent time together, as much time as they could manage, in quiet, out-of-the-way places, at her home, at friends' apartments, once or twice meeting in the same public place and not acknowledging each other. Again, since the affair with JFK was fleeting and over, it was RFK that Donaldson had fingered without mentioning his name as Marilyn's hopeful knight in shining armor, the one whom various credible accounts placed at her home, the one who had met her at her friend's, the Lawfords, on several occasions as the two spent time together, as much time as they could manage. After describing the well-known facts surrounding her death, including Marilyn's alleged ingestion of sleeping pills, Donaldson wrote, there is still the man who killed Marilyn. He is the man they can never arrest. He is the man still at large. He is the man who is the living, the death she so quickly found. We have lost her, but so has he. Concluding the article, the author added, wherever he goes, whatever he touches, whomever he sees, he thinks of Marilyn. His guilt never leaves him. His fear has become his friend. Some people know who he is. Will they ever reveal it publicly? And he himself, will his guilt pry his tongue loose? You will see him in a crowd. You can reach out and touch him, and you will never know that he is the man who killed Marilyn Monroe, and he is the man who killed himself. When FBI agent M.A. Jones read Walter Winchell's July 8, 1963, New York Mirror article about it, and then his column and Donaldson's article in the August 1963 Photoplay magazine, the agent drew several conclusions. As noted, Jones basically discounted Winchell's statement that Photoplay's current article on the man who killed Marilyn practically names him, stating, actually, the article comes nowhere near identifying anyone, while pointing out that the clues as to that identity have little merit. What Deloach and Clyde Tolson, and perhaps even J. Edgar Hoover, thought of the article is unknown. But one wonders whether these powerful men were as brain-dead as Agent Jones, since no investigation ensued, allowing a cover-up of the murder. As noted, Robert Kennedy's name was not mentioned in the article. But each of these men, if they knew anything about Marilyn's love life at the time, and it was no real secret, was aware that the world's most desirable sex symbol had first been a toy in the hands of President Kennedy and then his younger brother Bobby. Thus, the man was actually easily identified, especially if one reads not only the excerpts noted here, but the entire article. In fact, who else can it be other than the Attorney General of the United States of America? Just as author Fred Lawrence Giles wrote of the Easterner in his Marilyn biography, Legend, The Life and Death of Marilyn Monroe, another thinly disguised identification of RFK, the agent had to know that Donaldson had targeted him for ridicule. Certainly, the man who killed Marilyn was meant figuratively, not literally, although if Donaldson had known more about Bobby, including his having been in Los Angeles on the day Marilyn died, she might have revised her assumptions. On one point, Donaldson, who in all likelihood never mentioned RFK's name out of fear, but cleverly did so with her insinuations and factual basis pointing squarely in his direction, was certainly correct. He is the man they can never arrest. Even though clear indications of Robert Kennedy as the killer emerge, no investigation ever materialized to determine whether he might have actually had a hand in her death. Instead, as with other clues, including author Giles's portrayal of the guilty Easterner, no one, least of all the LAPD, run by Kennedy family friend William Parker, gave a damn about proving her death to be a murder. Even though RFK and Hoover had a relationship mostly packed with anger and distrust, perhaps Hoover decided to protect the Attorney General, believing he could call in the favor at some point in the future. The details given in Ms. Donaldson's article make it an impressive document due to her research, dogged in the spirit of that conducted by author Frank Capel for his book, The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe. Like him and author Giles, Donaldson was there during the time Marilyn died, proving her worth with detailed inside information, insight into the rocky relationship between the second most powerful man in America, the one known all over the world, the man you can read about almost any day in the newspapers and magazines, this man and Marilyn. Certainly, the author's recognition that it was the worst time of her life and the best time of his is right on point, although Donaldson seemingly wasn't aware that Marilyn was on the upswing with her career and private life, except for the love gone wrong with RFK. Unfortunately, although the sources Ms. Donaldson relied on, the people in Hollywood and in New York, are not identified, it appears they were quite credible based on the salient facts she provided. Even more credibility for Ms. Donaldson's reporting is Agent Jones's notation in the FBI memo. The article states that Miss Monroe's housekeeper has vanished and that her publicity agent, Pat Newcomb, is now working in Washington, D.C. In fact, Eunice Murray did vanish for a time to escape media scrutiny and, as proven through Newcomb's application for federal employment previously mentioned, filed by her on October 10, 1963, among the three references are Mr. and Mrs. Peter Lawford, Newcomb ended up working in the nation's capital for a time. Thus, Ms. Donaldson did have her ear to the ground regarding what had happened to both women, proving her research for the article was quite worthy, with the exception that she wrote of Marilyn telephoning the man on Sunday night, August 3rd, and telling him she had taken sleeping pills, which does not jive with the fact that there was no water glass found in the bedroom or the bathroom. On a par with Kilgallen as one of the best-known columnists in the world, Walter Winchell wrote, according to the memo, that although many of Miss Monroe's friends now believe the overdose of sleeping pills was accidental, he appeared to retain his opinion that she never committed suicide. Interestingly enough, on page 10 of the same photo play issue, under the heading The Midnight World of Walter Winchell, the columnist, referring to Donaldson's article, wrote, Marilyn Monroe's tragic exit and the married man responsible for it was still getting extravagant newspaper space in the foreign press as recent as the other day. The author of the articles, syndicated to leading papyri in Paris, Vienna, Rome, and other European places, prefaced his piece by stating that he personally had interrogated many persons in Hollywood and New York who knew Marilyn and her problems. He submitted his sensational story as being big news, and it was, in a way. Notice that once again Winchell referred to he and his, when obviously the author of the article, Martha Donaldson, was a woman, as noted in the magazine's table of contents and the end of the article. The reporter in him couldn't let go of the story, perhaps because he was jealous of her scoop and disappointed he had not written it. Of note, his writing "The Married Man Responsible for It," meaning Marilyn's death, appears to indicate that he does see some substance to the article, and certainly Winchell would have connected RFK to the married man. Winchell also confirms that the article was indeed being distributed in Europe, even to the point of naming Paris, Vienna, Rome, and other European places as home for its publication. This author's research has fallen short of specifically being able to designate what newspapers printed the article, but to date, there exists no evidence it was ever printed in U.S. publications other than Photoplay. Another noteworthy article also appeared in the same August 1963 edition of Photoplay, an extensive one entitled "JFK is Taking Over My Life" by actor Cliff Robertson. Here, the respected actor made reference to his being chosen to play Lieutenant Junior Grade John F. Kennedy in the motion picture PT-109, based on the president's heroics during World War II. Apparently, Warner Brothers, the producer of the film, acquiesced to the White House's request that the president approve the actor who could impersonate him on the movie screen. The article featured a full-page photo of Robertson, bare-chested with a towel and dog tags around his neck and a navy embossed hat sitting on top of his smiling face. Following the brief article were two pages of location footage under the banner "Exclusive in Photoplay, the complete movie story of PT-109. Action photos followed, showing Robertson, looking half-drowned in the darkened waters, pulling a fellow crew member to the beach. Completing the story and photos, a full-page ad touted the film, spouting the headline, "The Story of a Band of Men Left for Dead in the Flaming Sea and Their Fantastic Epic of Survival." A promotional picture showed the PT boat being demolished by a much larger ship. Next to this picture appeared another with the famous coconut embossed with the words, "Native knows position. He can pilot to a live Kennedy." The film was released on June 19, 1963, just months before John Kennedy's assassination. 60-plus days following the assassination, in August 1963, Photoplay had published both Martha Donaldson's article and the PT-9 exclusives, plus the movie advertisement. This same issue included another article, this one by James Gregory, connecting Robert Kennedy to the sub-headline on the cover reading, "The Suicide That Broke Jackie's Heart," a reference to First Lady Jackie Kennedy. The article began, "Indifferent himself to danger, he wept over the sorrow of others." Jackie Kennedy heard her husband's stirring words with ears that moments before had received shattering news. She saw the beauty of the White House flower garden, newly planted and fragrant with hyacinth, through eyes that were rimmed red from weeping. "He wept over sorrows of others," Jack's words, spoken in praise of Winston Churchill, who was being awarded honorary citizenship in an inspiring outdoor ceremony, were all too fitting for Jackie's own case. For Jackie, too, had been weeping over the sorrows of another. Another who, in many ways, had lived a life like hers. And that other woman's sorrow, there was no escaping this, had been caused in small part by Jackie's own brother-in-law, Attorney General Robert Kennedy. Gregory then told the rest of the story, starting with identifying the woman as Jackie's close friend Charlene Cassini, the wife of former society columnist Igor Cassini, who, under the pen name Charlie Knickerbocker, had named Jackie Debutante of the Year in 1947 when she was 17 years old. Summarizing what happened, Gregory wrote, "Like Jackie, Charlene grew up in a world of wealth, but for her, the gold became tarnished. A series of unhappy incidents, one involving Robert Kennedy and his Justice Department, caused the young and lovely Charlene to take her own life. Kennedy's Justice Department was part of the sad story after it, with RFK's approval, convened a grand jury and indicted Igor Cassini on charges of failing to register as an agent of a foreign government, in this case, the Dominican Republic. The allegations stemmed from when Cassini exposed, through his newspaper columns, the efforts of communists to overthrow the dictatorship government of Rafael Trujillo. A trial date was set for Cassini, which, along with news headlines, headlines ruining his reputation with the Hearst Syndicate, the same one Kilgallen worked for, put the columnist on leave from his column. Gregory wrote that Charlene suffered pain and embarrassment over the scandal since her family had close ties to the Kennedy family, especially Joe and Rose. Faced with additional public ridicule, Charlene became depressed and then overdosed by taking more than 30 sleeping pills. Jackie was devastated by her friend's death, Gregory believed, but he did not disclose whether the First Lady blamed her brother-in-law for failing to intervene in the case. Regardless, Jackie, aware of Bobby's crusade to rid the world of any wrongdoing while enjoying the publicity Cassini's case generated, must have wondered why the Attorney General would not have interceded, knowing, as he did, Jackie's close friendship with Charlene. If this was the First Lady's attitude, she did not know RFK very well, since his ruthless persona, the same one that had caused him to pursue Carlos Marcello and the other Mafia dons in 1961, in all likelihood meant he would have never interceded, even if Charlene had been Jackie's sister. That attitude, his holier-than-thou stubborn self, Bobby being Bobby, as Rose Kennedy understood early on, placed a target squarely on his brother, the president's, back. 4 months after Charlene's tragic suicide, JFK would be dead, giving rise to one journalist who did not want to be identified telling this author, "Bobby was nothing but an arrogant punk."